My name is Preacher, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Destina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and/or understanding. JJ will read the preamble.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is JJ. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Katie will read the steps.
I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic. The steps. Step 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of characters. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Johanna will read the traditions.
My name's Johanna. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. I was told to speak loud. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but just and servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group will never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Sean.
Hi, my name is Sean. I'm an alcoholic. Sean, can you guys hear me? Great. My sobriety day is October 12th, 2006. I just celebrated a year, and I'm really grateful for that. How my alcoholism really started out, let's start off, I'll tell you, you know, I was born in Detroit. I was brought in the Midwest. My parents, my dad was an alcoholic, and we had a really rough relationship. That doesn't make me an alcoholic, but... growing up, I had a real tough time in the neighborhood. I had a tough time in school. I had a tough time identifying with other people and having conversations until I discovered alcohol and drugs. When that happened, something happened to me. I became comfortable with myself enough to talk to other people, and it worked for me. It worked for me when I was making friends. It worked for me when I was talking to women. It worked for me in jobs. I was very, very fortunate. I was an artist, and I did very, very well. I was lucky enough to be employed, and that took me quite a ways. It took me all across the United States, and wherever I touched down, whatever city that I was in, there was always a bar, and I would always be able to make friends. And this is just kind of how I ran my life for several years. My career was really kind to me. I ended up, having the big apartment by the lake in the nice city, and the attractive girlfriend and all that. But I remember this one time when I was out in California. It's the first time I was out in L.A., and I saw the sunset for the very first time over the Pacific Ocean. And if you've never seen it before, it's one of the most beautiful things in the entire world. And there was nobody on the beach but me. I was a little bit sloshed, and I thought to myself, this got to be the most amazing thing that I've ever seen in my entire life. My second thought was, I am totally alone. There's nobody here to share this with me. And it was beyond, I just had nobody in my life, to share this moment with. And it was such a deep loneliness that would just, I couldn't shake it. All my friends had, grown up, and they had gotten houses and were starting to have kids. And, I thought, that's my problem. I need a house. I need kids. I need this. This is what's going to change me. And, so that's what I did. I moved to Minnesota, Minneapolis. And I don't know why Minneapolis sounded great, but it was just there. And I did that. I remember getting, the girlfriend that I wanted and the place and all that. But, what happened is that I started leading this double life. I was the perfect boyfriend. I was the perfect employee. And then when Miller time came around, I was dancing on speakers and going to the clubs and going to VIP rooms, it was a lot of craziness. But it treated me very well for a certain time. But things started to go different. It started not working for me. I drank every single day. I didn't drink all day, but most of the days when I was at work, I was working my way through a hangover. things started to go badly. You know, I went from having this huge place to getting a one-bedroom apartment, and from a one-bedroom apartment to getting a studio apartment to finally getting a share. And throughout all this time, you know, I never really, I didn't know what the problem was. I knew I had a drinking problem, but I didn't think that I was an alcoholic. You know, I thought that was different. I had an idea of what an alcoholic was in my head, you know, and that just wasn't me. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, I ended up in New York City here, and I moved to Manhattan. And by this time, there was no glamorous job anymore. I burned through a few of those. I'd even gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I thought, this is what I really need. You know, I really need to change my friends. You know, sometimes it was the girlfriend. Sometimes it was the girlfriend. Sometimes it was the job. Sometimes, you know, it got to be Minneapolis. Minneapolis was my problem, you know. And it was everything other than me. I had no accountability whatsoever. So, you know, when I got here, I just you know, I thought I would move to the city and I would revamp my my career, and I lost my job as soon as I moved here, and I had just enough money to make it through like the next month, which wasn't a whole heck of a lot, and I figured I'll just go to the bar, have a couple martinis, I'll figure out what to do, I'll write it down on a napkin, and I woke up the next morning. And I had withdrawn all my money, and I had spent it. So now I'm here. I don't know anybody. I don't have any friends. I don't have any families. And I'm tapped out. You know, I had this obsession to drink, which was so powerful. I couldn't go for longer than 3 days and not drink. And now I had no money. And on the third day, the obsession was so strong, I couldn't think of anything. I couldn't hold a conversation with anybody. I couldn't watch television. Nothing could distract me. I had to have a drink. I took the $20 that I had, put on my clothes, walked out my apartment, and walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I have absolutely no idea how I got here, to be quite honest with you. My intention when I left was to go to the bar. And I woke up, I just raised my hand, and you know, I was just sobbing. I couldn't do this anymore. You know, and all of a sudden, all these guys came in. They gave me their phone numbers. They started calling me. They started asking me questions like, "How are you feeling today? What are you doing?" And they expected answers. You know, and that I never had friends like that before. You know, it freaked me out. I said, "Get a service commitment." I got a service commitment, and I did all these things that were suggested: getting a sponsor, starting to go through the book. But still, I guess a couple points I want to make is that, you know, I didn't understand that I was an alcoholic. That took some time. I knew I had an obsession to drink. You know, I met a guy in the program here that, you know, he was kind enough to give me, you know, a little bit of work. And, you know, he's going to be all excited about this. And, you know, and he says, you know, you're going to stay sober, right? I said, sure. And he's like, no. He says, if you don't stay sober, this isn't going to work. And I said, I understand. He's like, I don't think you do. This is the end of the road for you. You're an AA. You have to understand that. And I said, I understand. He says, I don't think you do. This is the house, last house on the end of the block. You know, you hear a lot about how you're going to die if you keep on drinking. You're not going to die. You're too smart for that, I can tell. I've taught to you long enough. What's going to happen to you is you're going to end up living in a box with all your organs failing. Nobody's going to care about you, and no one's going to help you out. You're going to be begging for quarters for people. And if that doesn't happen, you're going to end up living in this really crummy place up in Washington Heights with you in a bottle, with the sheet over the window, and you know, you might find a woman, but she's not going to hang out too often. As soon as you run out of cash or you start drinking it through, she's going to be gone too. You know, I was so resentful he said that to me. I mean, how could he possibly know about the sheet? I didn't tell him anything about the sheet over the window. But he just, at that point, I started to understand that my life was out of control and I had to do something about it. And that was another realization that I had absolutely no power over it whatsoever. I had to realize that I was powerless and take some suggestions. Thank you. One of the highlights of this program, is, I think I had like 60-some-odd days, and it was around the holiday, and I told you I didn't have a great relationship with my dad because of his alcoholism, and it became very, very important to me to get in touch with him. I did right before Christmas, and I said, hey, you know, I got a handful of days. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm counting days here, and I wanted to talk to you about it. And he says, hang on. Let me turn down the TV. My dad never turns down the TV for anything. And he said to me, he says, go on. And so I told him, I said, you know, listen, I was always angry because you went to rehab and you got out and I thought everything was going to be fine. And it wasn't. You know, I didn't understand that there was a process. But now I understand the loneliness. I understand the fear that you went through as an alcoholic. And I just want to tell you, you know, you don't have to be alone for the holidays. You know, I really, I haven't been the best son in the world. And I just wanted to kind of... talk to you a little bit about that. Thank you. And for the first time in my life, I heard him choke. And he says, you don't know how much that means to me. I never blamed you for anything that you did. And it was the best gift. My dad passed away in June. So it was so great to get a chance to connect with him. But thank you for my sobriety. And please stay.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Colleen.
Hi, I'm Colleen. I'm an alcoholic. And there is no place in the world I would rather be than right here tonight in this room with all of you amazing, amazing people, whether you know it or not. I just want to say... you know, if this is your first time at a meeting, welcome. You're in a really, really wonderful place. And you've just got to stick around to find out what is in store for you. And you don't have to go through this alone. There are all these people here, and they want to help you, you know, because our recovery depends on it. And we've been exactly where you are. I've been exactly where you are. You know, there was one guy, Josh, that I met at a meeting yesterday, counting days, and I know you were struggling, and you showed up today, and that is just a power of example to me, you know, to show up no matter what. And, you know, thank you. Thank you, Eleanor, and everyone else for making it possible for me to speak here tonight. It's just such a privilege to be at my home group. And to be in this program. My sobriety date is August 3rd of 2004. My sponsor is Laura Rusher, who is here tonight from Connecticut, and I'm so happy. You know, I've been through the steps, and I'm currently going back and looking at a little bit of another fourth step. Because these tools that the you know that the steps give us really are what saved my life, and you know they're necessary. I first came into AA because I you know like Sean said it was you know I didn't know where else to go. You know my therapist wasn't helping me, my parents weren't helping me, they weren't you know bailing me out of situations. My father had said, you know, I don't think I want to send you back to college, and I have three other kids to raise, and you know what, you're not helping, and you know, if you can't change, you know, you're gonna have to leave, you know. I've got a family, and you're not the center of the universe, and that was the first glimpse of, you know, that I had that that maybe. Maybe I needed to do something, you know. Maybe I needed to be a little bit responsible for my life. And, you know, I came into this program first, I think, in 2000 and put some time together. But, you know, this I love that this is a program of action. And, you know, if I'm not in action, I can want to be sober. You know, I can want to be sober more than anything else in the world. And it won't matter if, you know, if I'm not walking the walk. It's just not for people that want it. It's for people that, you know, follow direction. And, you know, I came in here in 2004, and I got a sponsor. I was beaten. I knew that I knew that the alcohol was my master. I did whatever it told me to do. I went wherever it told me to go, and it was not always nice places. And you know, I had a big hole inside of me. And I came in, and I got a sponsor. I got a home group. I got service commitments. And I was willing to do anything, you know, because I had no answer. And you know, I looked across the table at my sponsor, and I saw a glow in her eye, and I understood that it was God, you know, and I was willing to follow her. I was willing to do what she was doing, because she looked like she had a lot more peace of mind than I did, you know. And I stuck around, and I got to learn a lot about this disease. I got to learn that it's you know, a 3-part disease: physical, mental, and spiritual. And you know, the physical part of my disease is that allergy that, like, once I have one, I just need to have more. And, you know, one of my examples is, you know, I was drunk, and I was sitting in a lounge chair, and I could barely open my eyes. And, you know, somebody came over and put my head up and went to go give me a drink. And I couldn't even say the word vodka, and I was just like, oh, is that Vadi? And I was about to, like, lift my head, you know, up for this drink. And she's like, no, it's water. And I was like, oh, no, like, you know, and just, like, put my head back down. But, like, you know, that is, like, I just need to keep filling that hole. And then, you know, the mental obsession is, I didn't go to movies when I was drinking. I didn't do anything that didn't involve drinking. You know, I thought about drinking 24/7. And if I went into a room and I learned that people were not drinking that night, I like, you know, I had a physical reaction, and I ran out of there, you know? And then the mental part I really got to learn a lot about when I first came into these rooms before I got involved in the steps. And I'm still learning a whole lot about that. The spiritual malady is, you know, just that big hole inside of me that I tried to fill with alcoholism. And today, you know, through the steps, I'm learning that we can fill that hole. And it's not with alcohol. It's not with anything tangible. It's, you know, it's a spiritual solution. And, you know, it talks about in our basic literature, a spiritual solution will solve all our problems. And, you know, I have found that it doesn't come quickly all the time, but I trust 100% that, you know, this program has shown me that I truly have an answer. You know, and it talks about God does not make too hard of terms with those who seek him. And, you know, God can be, you know, anything. You know, it just has to be something greater than myself. And, you know, that power, because I used to get all my power from drinking, you know, my courage. You know, I drank. I thought I was a very easygoing, you know, very carefree person. And, you know, I wasn't really exactly the girl I thought I was. It was alcohol, you know, that allowed me not to think. And the second, you know, I put down that drink, the voices in my head started to go, and I started to worry and want to control everything. And, you know, all the isms, you know, that I've learned about in this program start to come up. And in order to treat those things, I need the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, like I said, it's a program of action. And, you know, my sponsor has taken me through the steps, and, you know, in my fourth and fifth step, I got to learn that, you know, it wasn't the whole world that wronged me. You know, I played a part in every single situation. And, you know, that's the good news and the bad news. And the good news is that, you know, if I want to have a good life today, I can have a good life today. You know, I don't have to blame other people. If I'm there, I have a part. Sorry, I just need a drink. You know, the other amazing thing about this program is we get to live our dreams in this program and so much more. You know, I came in here and it was really the last place in the world I wanted to be. I was young and, you know, my friends were still going out and having a good time and thank you. And I thought I was missing out. And I just had to believe what the people in here told me because I knew I had a hurt inside of me, like you guys had. I wasn't even sure if I was an alcoholic right away, but I identified with your feelings, and you know, by sticking around and going through the steps, I've been filled. I am filled, and I always find my answer. With the help of this program, when I look for it, when I choose to seek it, when I choose to work this program, and you know, today I am a week from yesterday, I'm actually leaving for a job in a country where there's no AA, and there's one AA loner, and you know, I called up this AA loner and he said, "Oh, you're an answer to my prayers." And you know, this person was an answer to my prayers, and that is how this program works. You know, we just have to be willing to be open and keep searching for the solution. And I love all of you, and I thank you so much for my sobriety, and thank you for being here.
And our main speaker tonight is Patrick.
Hello, everybody. My name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic. Not bad. A sellout tonight, you know. I want to welcome all the visitors from out of town and definitely the people that are counting days that are coming, you know, because that's what's so important today is, you know, I've been around for a little bit and I get more from the people, listening to the people that come in, you know, that are, you know, struggling to get off the drink, you know, and I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I started drinking about 7 years old. I made my first Holy Communion, and I became an altar boy so I could drink more wine in the back of the sacristy, you know, and I loved it. I loved it from the beginning. I loved the nice, warm feeling it gave me in my tummy when I, you know, took a sip, and I chased it, you know. I'd be home. I remember when I was about a kid, my dad would be sitting in the kitchen and he'd be drinking a highball, and I remember the gas stations used to give these little shell things, and I remember looking into it and I'd see a glow and it was like a magic potion, and I'd swig it down when he went to the bathroom, and those sips became gulps and the gulps became finishing a drink, and I remember him coming back from the bathroom saying, "Who's been drinking my drink?" And I'd be giggling, you know, and I loved the little rush it gave me, you know, and right from the beginning I had my mind set on alcohol. So like I said, I became an altar boy. Every opportunity I had another friend, we loved to drink behind the altar while the mass was going on. I'd grab a big stack of hosts, I'd bite into them, whiff down a big guzzle out of the bottle, and I loved it. I figured there was no better place to drink than at the church, you know? And then I went back to school with a half a buzz on, you know, in Catholic school. You know, I had a nice childhood. My parents, both Irish, you know, put us in Catholic school. They did the best they could for me. You know, I played sports, did really well in that, and I just loved acting out. When I wasn't drinking, I was, you know, worried about getting into trouble or doing something to get away with, you know? I was a character, you know, and you know, when I was in school, you know, I remember when it was about 6th or 7th grade, we started chipping in a couple of bucks a piece. We'd find an alleyway, we'd chip in for a pack of Molsons or Michelobes, whatever the beer was going to be. And I remember my first six-pack, I chipped in with about 3 guys. And by the following week, it was 2 of us splitting a six-pack. And I couldn't wait till I graduated to my own six-pack. And it was within like 3 or 4 weeks, you know. This was in the spring, you know, in the fall, and all of a sudden, you know, the winter started coming around, and the beers got too cold to hold on to, and we went to movies and things, so we chipped in for liquor, and the only way we knew about liquor is what we seen advertised. I remember seeing guys on the corner, you know, playing Frisbee with a Jack Daniels shirt, so we'd send a derelict into the liquor store to get a bottle of Jack Daniels, and, you know, the first few times it was rough. You know, Jack was really rough the first couple times. I suffered dearly the next morning, throwing up, all kinds of stuff coming out of my guts. And I'd say I'll try something different. The following time was Southern Comfort, and that was another disaster. And, you know, I was kind of messy. I'd always throw up and everything, and then my friends would take care of me and get me home and, you know, mitt me up, and I'd get by my parents. And finally I hit, blackberry brandy, and that went down smooth. That was like cough medicine, and I loved it, you know. So I stayed with that for a while, and that's what we did. You know, when I was in school and a teacher was giving out the math lesson, I was just trying to figure out by the end of the week if I saved all my lunch money, how much I'd have and how much liquor I'd be able to buy, you know. And these are the things that were important to me. I loved it. Each time I always wanted to have a little bit more, you know. I enjoyed it a lot. I loved the rush from it. I love the trouble I could get away with, too. I wasn't afraid to do anything. I love breaking windows, you know, causing all sorts of trouble, you know, standing on the corner with a nice ball waiting for a bus to go by. And, you know, this is the things I did that I wouldn't, you know, and I'd make sure the windows were open when I threw these things, you know. I'd love to see the reaction on people and how angry they get and the thrill of running, you know. And these are the things I did. And I wouldn't do them normally the minute I walked out in the morning, but it was later on when I had a couple of beers or a couple of swigs or something. I loved it. I was very courageous, you know. And, you know, it went on for years. You know, the problem in the beginning was finding places to drink. We were small. We were like 12, 13. So we went to places like cemeteries and stuff. And we played, you know, Black Sabbath music and all. And we'd kiss our girlfriends behind trees. And, you know, all these little things that we did. And suddenly we got older and the parties became bigger. You know, they became keg parties. And we chipped in for keg parties. I remember all week worrying about a keg party. Wow, how are we going to get it there? We'd be pulling our little wagons down the street. And we'd be taking admission from everybody like I should be tonight with the crowd I have here, though. But, you know, We it was a lot of fun, you know. It was some music. It was a good time, you know, and I loved it. And in the beginning, it was all harmless, you know. And I definitely, it became, it was a Friday and Saturday night in the beginning, and it was hard to get away with my mother. Like, we'd go to the movies one night, and we really had no other place to tell we were going the next night, you know. And we just had to tell the movies again. And, you know, it got really good. You know, I loved it. When I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, you know. I thought about it all the time. I loved the thrill of it. Each time I went out was like it was going to be my last time. I loved the whole thrill of it, you know. I couldn't wait till I got out and sat on a stool in a bar, you know. My parents would bring us on vacations, and wherever I went, I always found the people like myself that liked to drink, you know. We'd hang out by creeks. We got a little older. We found bars that would serve us, you know. I was in 16, 17 on a stool. I remember they changed the age. I was so... You know, I already had a fake ID, and it was the wrong age now, and I had to go get another one. And, you know, these are the things I was worried about. I couldn't wait till the day I could slam my money up on the bar and order a JD and ginger ale, because it sounded good, you know. And, I got there, and, you know, I got all the trouble that followed it. You know, eventually at school, I found the crew going to school in high school that, you know, we had a little breakfast club, and it was about making little vodka and orange juices. And when I got into class with a buzz on, I couldn't stay around no more. It was like the teacher sounded like that one from Charlie Brown. You know, I wasn't capable of really learning anymore. I was worried about keeping that buzz going. You know, I loved it. You know, so I'd find a couple of people that had parents that were away. We'd go back to their house. We'd drink all day. And, you know, I'd do that, and I'd get caught up a couple of days with that. And then the next week, we had somebody's house open for the weekend. We'd be having a party every day. And eventually, I'd come home the one day from school, and my dad and mother and father would ask me how everything was going with school. And I would tell them it was great. And I'd be getting the beating of my life, you know. And, you know, they realized I wasn't there. There was letters sent home. They'd bring me back, smack me up a bit. And, you know, I would make sure the next time I wasn't going to get caught. You know, I'd make sure whatever teacher I had to show up to, whatever class, you know, to get away with it. You know, that's what I was always worried about, was getting away, whatever I was doing. We had no money for drinking. We lived in Jackson Heights. We figured out there was a buy and use sell furniture. So we took all the furniture out of the buildings and sold it. You know, we rifled whatever we could to get money for beers. You know, there was HBO antennas at that time. We took them off everybody's roof one afternoon just to bring them to someone to sell so we could have some money for drinking and partying. And these are the things we were doing, and these are the things we were thinking about. You know, I had a lot of fun. I got a little older, and I remember I showed up when I was taking my driver's permit thing, driver's license, junior license, and I showed up half-bombed one morning to go take the license. I got I passed and everything, and these are the things I thought nothing of doing. And within a week and a half, 2 weeks later, I was already getting my first DWI out by the Hamptons. You know, I ended up driving through somebody's house with my cousin in the car, and I was more concerned about, like, getting the car, you know, pulled away and everything. I remember some guy coming up and asking me if I was all right, and I was just, if you could just pull the car off the pole at this point, it won't look so bad when the cops get here, you know. And I ended up going to jail, and you know, I remember being waking up in that. It was in early July. It was like the July 4th weekend. I remember having a hangover, and it was 90-something degrees, and it was like the worst place in hell to be. And I said, you know, one of those prayers, like, if I could just get out this one time, this will be it. I've learned my lesson. You know, I'm done with this. And, you know, I appeared in front of a judge. I got home and everything, and I was already drinking somebody's backyard later that night, telling them, look what happened, you know, look at the trouble. And you couldn't scare me, you know. These are the things I did. My parents would be the ones that would come to court when, you know, they were, you know, I was facing charges, and they'd be standing next to me in front of a judge getting letters from a church or whatever people they could to, you know, try to hold me from going away. And, you know, and that would bother me, you know, because my mother would be the one standing next to me, and no matter how much she'd ask me, please, Pat, you got to calm down. Tonight, please don't go out. You're in enough trouble. And I would beg her, just like, you know, I promise you, this time I'm just going to go out for an hour or two. And I couldn't. Each time, when I was 18 years old, I had a trouble getting home. You know, my father told me 12 o'clock, and I couldn't. I'd get there 12:30, and I'd get beaten for it. And, you know, and then I found a way. They'd lock the doors. I'd climb through the windows. You know, I remember one night I climbed through the window in the middle of the winter, jumped into my bed, and my father was in there already, you know. And, you know, it was like the Tom Sawyer of drinking, you know. And, like, you know, I was just always getting into trouble. No matter how hard my parents beat me or talked to me, I couldn't stop, you know. When I stayed away a whole week, all I kept on thinking about, wow, I can't wait for the next one. We're going to go to the next party, you know. And, you know, this is what happens, you know. Eventually, I drank myself right out of school. The sports I was playing, I was really doing well with, you know. I kind of just got pulled away. Things like baseball, I loved as a young kid, and I sat there and even started playing when I had a few beers or whatever else I was doing. I never thought these things would get pulled away. I had talents and everything, but eventually everything started getting sucked away because I was kind of getting foggy, you know, and I never even realized it, you know. I realized I could go, I wanted to start working. I'd say I'd go to school at night and, you know, and I'd be fine. I remember going into the construction industry, and I got great jobs because people knew me and knew my family, and it was fine at first. I could go in, get paid on a Thursday, stay out all night, and then go to work the next day. And I did that, and I do it for two or three nights in a row. And eventually the one day came where I said, you know what, let me call up and say I'm not going to make it today for an after hours. And that was it. You know, it came to a point I couldn't make it to work after I got paid. I couldn't get home with the money. If I got home and gave my mother all the money that I'd borrowed all week, I'd be coming back in the middle of the night looking for it again, you know. And if I buried it, hid it, whatever, I couldn't. If I went out with no money, I found a way to get drunk. You know, I knew all the people that drank and did the partying that I liked to do, and I'd always find them, you know. I never realized in the beginning that it was such a problem, but, you know, I realized the troubles were getting bigger and bigger every 6 months or so. That's how I kind of measured it. It's like, wow, when people, my parents and everything were just coming out and about the last big arrest, something else would come up, and, you know, it would hit the fan all over again, you know. And it started to worry me a little bit, so I'd grab, you know, I'd get hostages, as they would say. I'd get a girlfriend or two, and I always made sure I went out with a girl that did no drinking and no partying, you know, and that was good for the few hours I was with her. But, you know, when I'd be with her, and, you know, and I was with her and at the movies or whatever and setting up for the next day, all I was worried about is fast as I could drop her off, shoot out, get all the partying I wanted done, and come back, grab her in the morning so I could be safe again, you know. And I couldn't do it, you know. I could do that a few times. I always got away with mostly, and all of a sudden, things caught up. I found the people I could stay out for a few more days. I'd stay with them, you know, and the troubles got greater. It started getting hard to keep the jobs down, because when it couldn't show up, you know, no matter how good of a worker I was Monday through Thursday, when I couldn't show up on Friday after getting paid, you know, the bosses started looking bad in companies, you know. They started warning me, please, you're great work and all, but it looks bad on everybody else when you don't come. They threatened people that we're not going to pay nobody on Thursdays if Pat don't make it. And it didn't matter. I promised people, and, you know, I was up against a big demon. I didn't even know how hard it was, you know. It got stronger and stronger as I went along, you know. If I went to weddings, I went there, I put on an expedition, I'd stay out the night before I went to a wedding, go to a wedding, and stay out for 2 days, you know, after a wedding. You know, it didn't matter. Whatever event I would go to, whatever it had to be, I'd be drunk, you know, and I loved it. As soon as I was able to get my license back, you know, I promised myself I would never get caught drinking and driving again. But it didn't stop me. I drank in bars, and I drove my car without the drinking in the car for a while, and, you know, it just never fazed me. You know, I never worried about what was going to happen. There was no consequence. You know, I always thought I was that one kid that was going to get away with it, you know. And, you know, the hurt at home became worse and worse after a while. You know, the sorrows, I got tired of hearing my own song after a while, you know, getting paid, going through the money. And when I didn't have a job, I'd be stealing at home, you know. I'd use my brother's, whatever I could, you know. And I started realizing at a certain point that, you know, there was a problem. You know, I knew it was somebody I ran into that I used to party with in an after hours. And I seen this guy on a Sunday morning, and I was waiting for the place to start selling beer. It was 11 o'clock. I was in a suit because I was at a wedding the night before. And the guy said, listen, I got to give you my number. And I was like, great, we'll get together. We'll have some more, you know, we'll do it up again. And he goes, no, I think you're ready for a meeting. And I was like about 23 years old, and I was like, wow, meeting. I said, that's great. I really appreciate you looking after me and everything. But that'll be fine. I put it in, and it kind of planted a seed. You know, within about a year or so after that, I found myself walking into a group called the Daily Dozen in Woodside, and I remember when the pain got so great, you know, because I got tired of constantly coming home and being up for 3 and 4 days. You know, I've been through a couple of times being arrested or whatever, and I felt the next time probably wasn't going to be jail. It was probably going to be the death, you know, because I was just out of control, you know, and it happened real fast for me and very early, you know. I ended up walking to a meeting. I put my hands up, and I figured it wasn't going to work, so I'd stay around just trying to get the jitters out of me and everything. People came up, gave me their hand. And the next thing they talked about, you know, making meetings, joining a home group, all these things when I first came in was really nice to the newcomer, I remember. They talked about eating candy and holding on to candy and, you know, all these things. Get 90 meetings, and make 90 meetings in 90 days. Get 90 numbers. You know, I started calling people just to play around and see if they'd take the phone calls. And, you know, I met all sorts of characters. I met sober bank robbers. I met my heroes in there. And all of a sudden, I realized if they could do it, I would be able to do it, you know. And they talked about 90 days. I figured 90 days sober, I'd be walking on water, you know, because they didn't know how really screwed up I was. I thought I was beyond repair, you know. But I showed up, and I said, I'll do everything they ask. And I said, when it doesn't work, I can go on my way, you know. And they said, you could we'll refund your misery, like they said, you know. But, you know, as I stayed around, you know, it was real rough in the beginning. You know, I suffered a lot. I didn't know anything about detox. I knew nothing about this disease. You know, I just thought drinking and partying and everything. I always thought that one day a boat would pull in and then, you know, I'd get married and have children and that would be it. I would be done with drinking and partying and I would go on a normal life. But I realized as things got worse and worse, I wasn't going to have any of that. There would be no girl to be married to and there'd be no life to be had, you know, and I stayed around. I made a week. I grabbed a home group. I started making coffee and had a big resentment. I made coffee at a pretty big group, not as big as here. And I made that for about a year. I hated making that at first, but I was like, you know, I don't even drink coffee, you know, and all these people, I'm down here an hour and a half before the meeting, but somebody told me there's sobriety in the coffee pot. So I did it, you know, and then after a while, I didn't want to let go of it. They had to tell me about it a year after, you know, you got to pass it on, you know, and eventually I stayed around. I was sober for a year. I started doing things. I went back to school, you know, I went to places like the doctor, the dentist, things that I forgot about, you know. You know, I thought I was indestructible, and all of a sudden I realized I had cavities and all these things wrong, you know. And, you know, I went and did them. They sound like, you know, like no big deal, but these are the things I wouldn't worry about when I was drinking, you know. And I went and did these things, you know. I in the relationship I was in, I wasn't drunk no more, so the girl that was with me had nobody to take care of anymore, so she was able to go on her way, you know. And I got to spend some time alone in AA, you know, and it was weird. I was sober about 2 years. I lost my job. The construction industry went down, and my girlfriend left and all, and I got to spend some time alone where it was very strange, you know, at first, you know, but I got comfortable. I forget to mention, in the beginning of sobriety, I didn't even go out on Friday and Saturday nights. There was a group that went out and bowled, so they dragged me to go out bowling after the first month, and I hated bowling, you know. Bowling was so, you know, it was ridiculous doing it, but I did it because they said, you know, stay with sober people or whatever, and I said, you know, they're all wing nuts here, you know, and at first, I wanted to have my other friends keep them on the side just in case I couldn't get along with these people. But I met the most wonderful people in AA. You know, I ended up meeting people like myself that loved doing exciting things. I jumped out of airplanes. I jumped on rafts and all. I had a lot of energy in the beginning. I'm getting older now, so I'm not as going as I was. But if you figure 16 years ago, I was bouncing off walls, you know. And, you know, it was really good. I met a lot of great people. I seen how these groups work. I went to conventions. I remember showing up at a convention. It was young people's convention. And like me and my friend, we had 6 months. We showed up to the convention. It was on a June night. And all of a sudden, these two young girls came running up and gave us these hugs. And me and my friend looked at each other and said, we're going to be getting over this weekend, you know, because I had no idea. I didn't know about the love and everything in AA. I didn't know about, you know, my mind was a little screwed up. Not as bad as now, but, you know, and, you know, these are the places I went. I went to conventions. I went to I went to rehabs. I went to hospitals, you know, loony bins, you name it. I was at them all. They took me by the hand and they brought me there, and I carried the message with some old-timers. Then I went to old-timers with everything that was bothering me. I had a lot of secrets inside that I had to do steps work and everything, and I remember fourth step took me almost a half a year to find somebody to sit down with. I was more worried about somebody that looked like they might be falling off anytime soon. This way they wouldn't go around and repeat what I had to tell them, and, you know? And, you know, I found that I was just like, as years went on, I found like I was just like everybody else. You know, I was very scared. I was a scared kid inside. You know, I did pretty much everything that pretty much all of us have did. You know, things I was ashamed of with parents and everything. I realized that I had a disease, you know, and by the longer I stayed, the more I shared about, the more step work I got done, I'd be having a good time, you know. I started laughing in AA after about 6 months from deep down inside of my stomach, you know. I hung out with people that like to keep us laughing with the same sick sense of humor. And there was this one guy in particular, Steve, I was, you know, I got sober with, and he always had me cracking up, and he'd be whispering things when people said they heard sounds, and he'd be whispering under the table at the meetings. He always did these sick things to keep me laughing, and unfortunately, he went out, and he went out around the time the Rangers won the Stanley Cup back in 94, and I had tickets for the Game 5, and I remember I was like, oh, God, of all times, and I knew I had to go to his funeral because I knew I had to see how real it really was. And before he had passed, he had told me, don't go out because this is what lies for us when we do, you know, and he had it so right. We had talked to each other all the time about the kind of partying that we liked and then the kind of sobriety and how good the sobriety was doing for us, you know, and unfortunately, he didn't make it. And all the time he told me at that funeral, don't worry, Pat, you'll make a lot of anniversaries, but you'll also make a lot of funerals. And he was so right. You know, I've got to see a lot of things over the years. I've been really blessed with a lot of fine people I've met, but I've also found that people that, you know, that didn't take this program serious ended up in coffins 6 feet under, you know. It's not a joke, you know. I realize that I'm only an arm's length away from a first drink, you know. I still think I'm sober 92. I'll be 16 years in January, and it's not a day that don't go by that I don't forget about a drink in one way or another. You know, I'm always attracted to the guy on the street that's taking a swig off, who's living on the street taking a swig out of a paper bag, because I know that rush he's feeling, you know, and I don't ever want to forget. The person sipping on a martini I could give a crap about, you know, but it's the guy that's having that drink that's been waiting for so long for it. I remember the feeling, you know, and I've done a lot of work in AA, you know, the friends, you know, I had a lot of things, too. I didn't mention when I was growing up, I was a bit wild. And I would always, you know, people that were different from me, I'd have things to say to them when I had a couple of drinks. I went to Catholic school, and we out on Wednesdays. I remember there was a little Hebrew school up the block, and the bus would go by, and I had some not-so-nice things to say and things like that. And I was never, that was never put into me or anything, but these are the things I did and the nastiness I was when I was drinking. There was a gay community started in Jackson Heights, and when I had a couple of drinks and I seen a couple of gentlemen or whatever walk up the block, I'd be the one snickering, snarling at them as they went up, you know. And, you know, to show you how, you know, funny sense of humor God has. I ended up marrying a Jewish girl after about like 5 years sobriety, and I have two little Jewish kids that could be on that bus, you know? You know? I work for flower designers now, so they sign my check, you know? They're the most loyal ones going, you know? God definitely does have a funny sense of humor. Everything comes into full circle, you know? And only in sobriety, you know, I would ever found these things out, you know? I can't say enough for the program. Life has been really good in here, you know. I still got a lot of work, so I still come to a lot of meetings, you know. I'm still, you know, I come more for the thinking now because, you know, I have a lot more responsibilities. AA has been really good to me. I have a little family, and I don't want to have to go back to drinking because I know I won't be able to hold on to them, you know, otherwise, you know. I might not be the best dad and everything and the best husband, but I try my best the day to time being sober, you know. I would have never met my wife if it wasn't for me, not drinking or whatever. She would have had nothing to do with me, you know, and I've been really blessed that way. And I think I'm running out of things to say, but I want to thank you all for listening, and thanks again.